This is Living Planet.
Hi, this is Neil. Now, if you've ever wondered whether it's worth offsetting your flight, this might actually be the perfect episode for you, because we're doing a deep dive on the world of carbon offsets, and we're going to try and figure out whether they're going to help us lower CO2 emissions or if they are in fact making the problem a lot worse. And I'm joined in the studio now by Kathleen Schuster, my colleague.
Hey, Neil.
You're from the US, right? So this is, you've got a vested interest in trying to minimize the damage you do with your flights, I assume, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been trying to lower my carbon footprint, as many of us have been, but I can't really avoid flying back to the US because that would then mean I don't get to see my parents or some other relatives. So I decided to do a bit of research, and I'd like you to try something out for me. So if you could Google offset my flights, and I'm going to do this at the same time.
Yeah.
And does a website come up for you called Trees for All?
Yeah, got it.
So that was one of the first search results that I got.
Okay.
Okay, so the scenario is return flight, departure, Frankfurt Airport.
Okay. Destination?
We're going to say Atlanta.
Atlanta.
Atlanta. So it's ATL is the...
ATL? Because I've got ACY.
This was supposed to be a simple experiment. Somehow this is becoming really complicated.
I've got it. Three persons, right?
Yeah.
Calculate emission, it says here. 6.98 tons of CO2.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So that's what I got. So one way I could offset this would be paying a one-time amount of 139 euros. That's about 150 US dollars, or a monthly amount of 1163. And so I thought this was really interesting because I don't know about you, but I mean, I know... this amount of CO2, that's more than what a car emits being driven for 1 year. Like, I think a car is estimated at about 4.9 or something like that. But I find it really abstract. It's like, where do they get that number from? Is this legitimate just looking at the website? I mean, I can go ahead and pay and then have my sins absolved, so to speak. So I decided to put in a few calls to experts who look at this sort of thing. And I found this one expert who I found very intriguing named Elias Airy. And he co-founded a company called Renoster. And like their whole job is to help other companies determine whether carbon offsets that they want to purchase are legitimate or just a bunch of bunk. And yeah, he's the chief science officer. So I told him these numbers and this was his reaction.
That would be far too low.
And yeah, why is that?
Well, I mean, these are only global averages, but I would say on average, it usually costs about $20 to $30 a ton to really have an impact if you're going to be either planting trees or competing with timber production. So that's what it actually costs to either do the work or to, you know, take a forest out of timber production and prevent it from turning into agriculture.
Okay, but hold on there. I mean, these projects, they're not all necessarily forests, right? So, I mean, what's the...
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you start looking at these websites, there are all different types of projects out there. There are like renewable things, you know, like solar, wind. But I was really intrigued by the forest angle because somewhere between 40 and 50% of these projects out there that somebody like you or I could invest in, so to speak, to offset our carbon footprint, they're forestry projects, either planting a forest, protecting a forest from deforestation, whatever. And also there's something really appealing about, I don't know any other way to put it, but like you're causing this pollution, maybe you can't avoid it, or that's what we tell ourselves, we can't avoid it. And then somewhere in the world, there's a beautiful tree helping us out that's sucking up all the carbon, right? I don't know. To me, it's a very romantic notion.
No, I mean, it could also be a tree that burns down in a forest fire. You know, we're having a lot of those.
Well, yeah. And I mean, and that's the other thing, because it's like, because of climate change, we're also seeing these unpredictable weather patterns. And so I also wonder, like, how sure of a thing is this?
I mean, to be honest, the whole topic, I don't know, but I've always been quite skeptical of it.
But yeah, this winding road of like looking at these websites and trying to figure out as a consumer, like how legitimate is this? Like just talk about opening a can of worms, because Elias isn't the only person that I talked to, but he's one who definitely has a really interesting story as to why he, yeah, even works in the market, because he's actually a huge critic of carbon offsets, but he's also trying to get people to buy good ones.
Okay,
so he's completely intriguing.
Or confusing. I'm sort of wondering, I mean, just, I don't know what the story's going to be. I'm going to come back at the end of the show and we're going to talk about it, what you discover, of course.
Well, I'm curious to hear your opinion because I know that you've worked on this topic before, so we'll see if we can surprise even you. A few years ago, Elias Erey, who we just heard from, stepped into the world of carbon markets thinking he knew what the problems were. He just finished his PhD in forest science in Maine and then got a job with a carbon broker.
And my role at that broker was essentially to evaluate projects that we were looking to broker and figure out if they were good or bad. And the broker that I worked for put a lot of effort into figuring out if the credits were good or bad.
A carbon broker buys and sells carbon credits. Essentially, Elias thought the problem with carbon credits was a technological one. Better technology would mean better offsetting, or so he thought.
And so in my role there, I think I was one of the first people in the markets to really do a really market-wide survey of carbon credits that were floating around out there. And what I found was really disturbing.
He says about half of the projects that came through were low quality, and in some cases, the projects were selling bad credits, really bad credits.
People knew that there was bad stuff happening inside these projects. It just wasn't being reported on. So one of the earliest projects that we looked at had massive amounts of deforestation inside of it. And this is a project that was designed around conserving the forest.
Where?
In Brazil. So it was the edge of the Amazon rainforest. What happened essentially was that a large project developer enrolled a lot of community land, and the community didn't really have the capacity to stop deforestation in and around its community. And the police in the community had no intention of putting their lives on the line to stop deforestation. And so essentially that project had failed to stop deforestation, and yet its credits were still and still are circulating around.
They're still circulating.
Oh, yes. Very few carbon projects have ever been canceled following a scandal. In fact, single digits.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly. So if I were to find some great project in the Amazon rainforest that says that they're helping preserve the forest, and I think, great, I can offset a flight, I'm going to do this, it could actually be the case that it hasn't done anything, that it's actually been deforested.
Yes, that happens quite frequently, that the trees are already cut down and they just haven't reported it and probably never will. Having come to that conclusion, I was really shocked. And I wanted people to know that a lot of these carbon credits that they were buying weren't having the impact that they thought they were. Because at the end of the day, I do think of myself as a climate scientist. I mean, I have a PhD in this space, and I'm not here necessarily to broker credits. I'm here to have an impact on climate change.
So then Elias does a 180. He leaves the carbon broker firm, and he also starts putting himself out there on YouTube.
Carbon credit contract lengths make no goddamn sense. And I'm not just talking about the obvious, but let's go ahead and start
separate videos that nobody watches. So I want to dump all of the ways in which people can cheat and forest carbon projects.
I'm just some carbon, just some tubular carbon. And I'm
to be fair, he doesn't sing in most of his videos.
It's a long, long journey from the trees to the city. And
but it is kind of refreshing to see someone try to make an incredibly complicated and depressing topic at least a little bit entertaining.
But I hope to be a credit someday.
And he doesn't stop there with his work, but we're going to come back to his story in a moment.
Be preserved to fulfill someone's offsetting bill.
Okay, let's back up really quickly. We've skipped over a lot of information, and if you really want to know what's behind carbon offsets, the first step is to wrap your mind around the carbon market. First, there's the voluntary carbon market. That's where pretty much anyone can go to buy a carbon credit, like the website we heard about at the beginning of this episode. You might have also heard of something called compliance markets. Those are the carbon markets that are government regulated, like what the EU has and California has one too. But that's not all. There are also programs like Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which sets how countries can transfer their carbon credits to help other countries meet their climate targets. If you're thinking, wow, that's a lot, Yes, it is. It's a huge market, and it's worth billions. The compliance market alone, so the government-regulated ones, were worth $909 billion U.S. dollars as of 2022. And by comparison, the voluntary carbon market is actually pretty small. In 2022, it was worth about $2 billion U.S. dollars. That's actually an astounding number, because that's four times what it was worth in 2020. And that's really important to consider because the everyday people buying these carbon offsets are doing so under the assumption that they're doing something that will help slow down climate change. And I'm going to send you three different links. Let's look at the first one, Trees for All.
Real quick, let me pull that up.
I wanted to get another opinion on those websites for offsetting my flight, so I reached out to a climate researcher who's seen the same problems crop up over and over again with carbon offsets for years.
I'm Danny Cullenward, and I'm a senior fellow with the Climate Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania.
Danny is a climate economist and lawyer, and he's also a member of different technical advisory groups from California's cap and trade to the Paris Agreement. But here in this capacity, he's just speaking as a researcher.
You said round trip, right?
We go through the same spiel. Is there anything initially that you see where you say, okay, I've seen this before and this is kind of, this is legit or this is kind of shady?
I mean, I've seen all of these words before. Part of the problem is there's things I look for as an expert that are usually not presented to consumers, which is what's the project? What's the methodology? I go straight to the technical information because pretty much all of the words around certification and monitoring, it's all nonsense talk. And the only thing that matters are the technical standards. And that's where I need to go to start answering these questions.
So those technical questions Danny once answered really need an expert eye. Let's say the project claims to be protecting a forest from getting cut down. The most important questions are, first, was this forest definitely going to be cut down in the first place? That's what's referred to as additionality. In other words, is the project truly leading to new carbon reductions? The next question Danny and other experts would ask is, what's the baseline? So, if the forest gets cut down, how much CO2 would that have released into the atmosphere? And by not cutting it down, how much CO2 would it be storing? Keep in mind, those are only two of the questions Danny says need to be asked. There are many other questions about how long the project will last, whether it will have any knock-on effects to surrounding areas, etc., etc., etc.
It turns out the rules are really hard to write to create sensible market structures and high-quality outcomes, because all of these rules are premised on what we call counterfactual baseline scenarios. So you say to somebody, what would you do if I didn't pay you? Were you going to do something bad? Were you going to put pollution in the atmosphere? Were you going to cut down a forest? Well, maybe I can pay you to not do that. And you can't verify what that person says they were going to do. They can tell you the story about what they were going to do to their forest or they were going to build a coal power plant, but they never actually do it. They do something else instead. And we can never really see what they would have done. And all of the incentives in these programs are in place for people to exaggerate and sometimes falsify their claims. And I think that's really at the root of what's made it hard to create high quality credits. You're asking people what they would do if they don't get paid, and they have an incentive to tell you a particular story. It's hard to write rules that turn the screws and make better answers come out of that situation.
So who exactly is writing these rules anyway? Could I, for example, just plant some trees in my backyard and sell some carbon credits? Well, no, probably not, is the short answer. And that's because there are four entities I would have to deal with. First, you have what are called registries. They're generally the ones who are writing the rules and issuing the credits. Then you have the project developers. They create the projects and sell the credits. After that, you have the auditors who make sure the projects comply with the rules. And remember, the registry generally is the one who wrote them. And last but not least, you have the brokers. They buy and sell the credits. Some take a magnifying glass to the projects, like the company Elias worked for, but he says not all of them do that. So there's not really much oversight, if any, and that's a problem, especially considering the top project developers are based in the US and the EU, while most of the forest-based credits are in the global south.
Tropical forests around the world are some of the most important ecosystems. They're being deforested rapidly. There is a serious crisis there. And if there are things we can do to intervene in that crisis and stop it, that's a worthwhile thing to do. It's also turned out to be one of the most problematic areas of carbon crediting. because the methodologies that are used in the industry to issue these carbon credits allow project developers to tell very exaggerated stories about how much deforestation would happen if they don't get paid. And there's a really well-documented example. A team of authors published a piece in the scientific journal Science arguing that about almost 95% of the carbon credits that are being sold from these tropical forest projects aren't doing anything. And it's a very interesting finding because they actually found that several of the projects they looked at were making improvements. They were slowing down deforestation. They were having an impact. It's just that the baseline story that they told to earn carbon credits, what they say would have happened if they didn't get paid, was so thoroughly exaggerated that 19 out of 20 of the credits weren't delivering anything real. So you were both supporting a little bit of good, but most of the credits weren't reflecting real climate benefits, and that should give you some sense of how out of whack these standards can get.
This is also what Elias was getting at in his story about deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. He says the shortcomings of that project were really complicated because it did stop some deforestation, but the amount of deforestation that did take place was severely underreported. In other words, the people who bought those credits weren't making the impact they thought they were. So going back to my own flight emissions, according to one website, I need to offset 6.9 tons of CO2 for a return flight from Germany to the States. That's for three people. Another website has a higher estimate that's almost double that. But how much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway? Well, it depends on the type of tree. It depends on the age of the tree. Some forests can store over 1,000 tons of CO2 per hectare, while others only about 10. And what about the biggest sticking point of all for scientists? How long can we count on these forests being there, playing their role in carbon removal? Elias points out that the Amazon rainforest has been storing carbon for the last 55 million years or so. Again, he sees people as the problem, not the forest. But carbon offset projects are a mixed bag with problems that go well beyond climate change.
Really, the reason I do what I do is because I don't think in any industry there's such a wide divergence in outcomes. I have seen carbon projects that are paying over 200,000 small families in impoverished Africa to plant trees on their farms. And for example, the nation of Uganda, thanks to one of these projects, is visibly greener from space. So without doubt, these carbon projects can have a really positive impact.
For the record, Danny agrees with this point too.
But at the same time, on the same market, and often being sold by the same carbon broker, you can have carbon projects that are almost entirely fraudulent and have human rights violations inside of them. And one of the ones that I've come across that I don't think has gotten enough attention is an avoided deforestation project in the Congo called Maindombe.
A few things to note here. Maindombe is a province in the western part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's an area roughly the size of England, and most of it is covered by forest. The project Elias is referring to is part of the UN's Red Plus program, which stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation in Developing Countries.
And this project is set up by a Western project developer based in San Francisco. They've probably earned about $200 million in carbon credits so far. We found the project's claims to be entirely unsubstantiated. We find the credits themselves to be almost entirely fraudulent. So we think that the carbon project itself is getting eight times more credits than it should, because it's basically protecting a forest that is a swamp forest. It's called a swamp forest. That's the actual name for it. And there's no reason that anyone on the ground would ever have to convert this land. You know, if they converted this land to agriculture, it wouldn't be agriculturally productive. And there's no real timber that you can get off this land because, you know, the trees are not typical commercial timber species. So the credits themselves we found are bad. But what's even worse is what's taking place inside this $200 million project. Because about 10 years after the project was started, a group of reporters and a nonprofit group went and visited the site. And the first thing that they encountered was that the project developer, again, this American company, tried to bribe the local officials, the local police, to arrest them for interviewing people. And, you know, we just have the word of this these group of reporters that this happened, but it seems fairly likely that this may have occurred. When they were able to interview people, what they found was that 68% of people living inside this project didn't even know they were inside of a carbon project. So these people are supposed to be stopping deforestation in and around their houses. They didn't even know that they were part of this. 94% of people inside the project didn't even know they were entitled to some chunk of this $200 million. And the actual revenue sharing ended up being, after 10 years, somewhere between 10 and 78 cents.
Sorry, and you said people got, I'm sorry, did I understand you correctly, 70 cents?
Because these projects often don't disclose really basic stuff like how much money they're paying to people, the conclusions of that report found that somewhere between 10 and 78 cents per person after 10 years had been distributed on the ground.
A quick correction. It was actually between 10 and 76 cents, not 78 cents. Those numbers come from a 2020 report by the Rainforest Foundation UK.
The worst part may be that because this American project developer doled out the money, what little money they did actually share, they shared very unequally. So they shared it with some communities and not others. And that caused violence between the communities that had received a little bit of the benefits, very small percentages, and communities that had received nothing. So there were widespread human rights violations inside this project in which the carbon credits themselves hadn't been doing anything for anybody.
So remind me again why you think it's good to buy carbon credits. How do you have faith in this kind of scheme?
I have zero faith in the system getting it right, but there are groups that do get it right. So the reason I still work in this space is because I have seen it work. And so my own company's numbers estimate that about 75% of the nature-based credits that we've evaluated, we don't think are doing anything. That's really terrible, right? But it does still leave hundreds of millions of tons that have done something. And so the reason I still keep doing this is that the industry could be fixed if it were regulated. If common sense rules were put in place, it could work. And I know this because I have seen it work a lot of times. It just doesn't work the majority of times.
We'll be right back.
In 1986, I was flying for the Navy, and the biggest threat to U.S. national security was the evil empire. These days, though, there's another threat out there, climate change. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and on How We Survive, we go to the front lines where climate change meets national security and discover how the U.S. military is shaping our climate future. Listen to How We Survive wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we're back in the studio now, Kathleen. Very interesting. Also, rather messy, though, all round, thinking about, you know, the carbon market. A lot of aspects there that you included in your story. I mean, one of my main questions, you know, straight off the top would be, is anyone trying to clean up this mess?
Aside from Elias and Danny? Yeah, absolutely. There's a really interesting example I didn't get to, and that is that in California, they passed a law the beginning of 2024 called AB 1305. And basically, it requires any company who's doing anything with carbon credits, they could be marketing them, buying them, selling them, they have to be completely transparent about what projects they are, what the measurements have been. And basically, if they fail to do this, they could be fined a maximum of $500,000 for failing to do so.
Hmm. Has that ever happened?
Well, the bill went into effect at the beginning of 2024, but the compliancy deadline doesn't start until 2025, from what I can tell. So
we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. But it is really intriguing because, you know, based on what we heard, how would you do this? Mm. It's really, really complicated. And we should emphasize again, you know, we're only talking about somewhere between like 40 and 50% of the voluntary carbon market, these forestry projects. What about the other 50% of renewable energy products? I mean, it's a never-ending story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But okay, I mean, that at least would signalize there's a bit of hope that it's no longer a wild, wild west situation.
Yeah, and you know what else is making an impact? Because there has been so much bad press, you know, earlier I said the voluntary carbon market had hit $2 billion. Now, that was in 2022. Last year, that market plunged by 60%, so down to around $720 million because of all the bad press. So you had a lot of companies going, wait a second, should we really be sinking our money into this? And like Elias was saying, things that he worked on several years ago, where it's you know, they know for a fact that what is being claimed is not actually true or parts of it aren't true, you can still buy those credits. So it's interesting to see the voluntary carbon market lose value. But I mean, it's still worth a lot of money. And there are still people out there who all you have to do is Google offset my flights and there you go.
So, I mean, what can consumers do to figure out if a carbon offset is real or not, or if it's a good idea or not? Well, I mean, what can you do?
Okay, so the first thing that both Elias and Danny said was you need to look at what the projects are. You need to take a look under the hood, so to speak. But they also said they don't think it's possible for a consumer on their own to figure this out, because they, as experts, they need time to do this. This is their bread and butter, and they have a hard time figuring it out. So I would say if you're dead set on buying a carbon offset, whatever it is that you want to offset, the first thing you should do after maybe figuring out where you want to buy an offset is to Google the project that you find and see if there's been anything written about it, whether it's, you know, problems with deforestation or a project that was already in the works and this is just kind of, you know, smoke and mirrors, or human rights violations. So that would be the smartest thing to do, is you have to do a little bit of research on your own.
I mean, I also remember, because I also did a story on this some time back, and I talked to the CEO of Atmosphere back in the day. That's an offsetting scheme based in Germany. And
I looked at one of those.
You looked at one of those, right? Yeah. And he told me, because I asked him, one of the questions I asked him, because I was interested, if I put, say, X amount of money into this offsetting scheme, how much actually really ends up in the project that they're supporting? So I was asking for their overheads, basically. And he was saying that they were at about 5% back then. This is a couple of years ago. And he said that was a pretty good value. So I think that's also something maybe would be worth asking these companies. How much money is really going in? How much money is lost along the way to middlemen or God knows what? Because if they're transparent, they'll tell you. They'll say, okay, our overheads are X percent.
Yeah.
And then you know. So, I mean, that was one thing. I mean, the other thing that I also wonder about, you know, with this story, the whole thing, I do find it suspicious that a lot of these projects are in distant, faraway lands where it's difficult to follow up in the first place. And I mean, one statement that Elias also made in your story was that very few carbon projects have ever been cancelled following a scandal, right? So even if they're caught red-handed, nothing happens. They're not taken to court or anything. And I sort of wonder, you know, with the proximity aspect, if I wanted to, you know, hold these people to account, I mean, which lawyer can I hire that would actually take that on and be successful? It's next to impossible, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a huge question, but Danny had a good point in saying that, you know, there's good reason to be protecting tropical rainforests. We're not even doing enough. We're, you know, we need to be doing more, but he disagrees that this would be the way to do it. Or he thinks there are good projects, but all in all, this market is just completely messed up. I've wondered about that too, because, you know, what if you could go out and drive and see, okay, there's my project.
Yeah.
But I think even then, not, like as a non-expert, if you're looking at a forest, for example, or renewable energy project, there are still so many things that you wouldn't know to look for. I mean, it's just, it's a huge promise. And it really comes down to you're giving somebody permission to pollute. And, you know, and the message of a lot of these experts is, okay, that's nice. It's a nice thought. It might make you sleep better at night. Those are my words, not theirs. But at the end of the day, if we want to do something about CO2, we actually have to reduce emissions. We can't just transfer the problem somewhere else in the world and say, okay, I'm going to be good now and you can be bad and you can be bad and I can be good. We really have to reduce emissions in a real way. Otherwise, the problem will just continue to grow with climate change.
Yeah. So next time you go to the US, will you be offsetting your flight?
Oh, God. You're going to ask me. No, I don't. I don't think so. But you know what I'm concerned about? Like buying a ticket where they have some sort of an option and being like, oh, that sounds good. No, I don't think this is the way to help my carbon footprint. But I don't know. Maybe if there were a really, really good project. I think I always bring a healthy dose of skepticism to most things that I do in life. So I feel very skeptical about this. But it's funny because while researching this, somebody I know posted something, I think, on Instagram about like offsetting flights and do something good for the planet. And I just thought, I'm just going to bite my tongue now.
That's it. I think it's time to wrap up. Thank you very much, Kathleen. That was a very interesting episode. If anybody listening to this would like to comment or has any suggestions for other topics that they'd like us to cover here on Living Planet, please do send us an email or a voice message to livingplanet@dw.com. You can also engage with us via DW Podcasts on YouTube or leave ratings and reviews on podcasting platforms such as Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, always very much appreciated there, obviously. This episode was produced by Kathleen Schuster and edited by me, Neil King. Our sound engineers were Michael Springer and Jürgen Kuhn. And that's it. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.